Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. A New York State of Mind. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
Manhattan's Upper West Side is known for many things: Central Park, posh apartments, and a way of life that seems romantic, bourgeois, almost untouchable. Most people don't think of the Upper West Side as a breeding ground of a psychoanalytical cult, one that gripped hundreds of affluent New York intellectuals at their most vulnerable. And yet, here we are. At its peak in the mid to late 70s, a therapeutic institute with as many as 600 patient members clustered in apartment buildings on Manhattan's Upper West Side, touting polyamory, communal living, partying, group parenting, and extreme socialist politics through the deep psychoanalytic work of Harry Sullivan and his egomaniacal disciple, Saul Newton. Today on Ghost Town, a metropolitan cult of the most disturbing order, the Sullivanians. In the 1950s, the U.S., specifically New York City, had a huge preoccupation with psychoanalysis and therapy. Time magazine had put Freud on its cover 3 times between 1924 and 1956, and Americans were hungry for new ideas, explaining a post-war thirst for knowledge, answers, and clarity. Freud's thinking especially impacted the white-collar social circles of New York City, which, at the time, had the largest concentration of psychoanalysts in the United States. Herbert, known as Harry Sullivan, was one such analyst to worship Freud's teachings, an American neo-Freudian psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who held that, quote, personality can never be isolated from the complex interpersonal relationships in which a person lives. Sullivan was all about the social context of the human mind, devoting years to studying how psychiatry functions in the field, and developing a theory called the self-system, referring to an internal self-policing mechanism that generates acquiescence to familial and societal expectations, of which I am, and perhaps you are, very familiar with. With a group of other psychoanalysts, Sullivan founded the William Allenson White Institute in 1943, considered by many to be the world's leading independent psychoanalytic institute. There, Sullivan emphasized peer friendships, what he called chumship, and used the philosophy at the White Institute to help socialize schizophrenic patients by hiring devoted male attendants to bond with them day in and day out. Though Sullivan died in January 1949, just 6 years after founding the White Institute, his work was not lost on a young man named Saul B. Newton, an extreme thinker who felt the White Institute had not taken Sullivan's work to the next logical level, breaking the individual from their family unit altogether. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The son of Canadian-Russian Jews, Saul Newton was always a combative, abrasive figure who attended the University of Wisconsin, my alma mater, before becoming a communist labor organizer in Chicago. He served in the Spanish Civil War and fought in World War II, after which he became staunchly anti-fascist and began independently studying politics and psychology. Saul Newton met psychoanalyst Jane Pierce in the early 1930s in Chicago and reconnected with her in the late 40s while working in New York City at the White Institute. Newton worked in the bursar's office, while Pierce, a huge fan of Sullivanian teachings, trained at the Institute before becoming a member of the faculty. In 1957, Newton and Pierce married and left the White Institute together, founding their own organization, the Sullivan Institute, a nod to their debt and deep interest in Sullivan's work. Pierce, already a successful New York City analyst, had her clients follow her to her new institute, along with a group of younger therapists that trained under her. Conveniently enough, she had also inherited money from her father's estate, which enabled her and Newton to buy a 5-story townhouse on the Upper West Side to house the married couple and their new institute. By word of mouth, the Sullivan Institute grew, developing a bit of a reputation in New York creative circles as a hot new place to dive deep into the psyche. Some of these creatives included Dee Agee, daughter of writer James Agee, famed art critic Clement Greenberg, and abstract expressionist artist Jackson Pollock. A few years after establishing the Sullivan Institute, Newton and Pierce began the social experiment that truly characterizes their work. For Newton and Pierce, the nuclear family was the root of all evil, the genus for evolution of all human pathology. So they asked their patients to partake in a world, essentially, without family, instead deeply promoting a more communistic lifestyle, with independently forged social bonds that contributed to a shared economy, including everything from money to sex to parenthood. Their dream for the Sullivan Institute was to create a world where people could live, quote, with peers rather than families, while pursuing sexual freedom. Yes, they made that specific sexual distinction right off the bat. To get closer to this communistic lifestyle, Newton and Pierce knew they had to move slowly. First, they encouraged their patients to renounce their parents and other blood relatives. One member ceased contact with her 12-year-old sister because the girl stopped going to therapy. Then they asked their most serious patients to live in shared, single-sex group apartments. These patients, again, lived with roommates and cultivated close platonic relationships with them. Think of like a giant sleepover every night or a kind of adult boarding school. Patients filled date books with sexual encounters and study dates, along with friendship dates, group classes, and the aforementioned sleepover with many of their same-sex friends. Every weekend, there were also wild parties, quote, which invariably ended with everyone pairing off and going to bed with someone else. To do otherwise was seen as a refusal to grow, a fear of pushback to the Sullivanian ideals. And yet, along with sex and friendship and parties and cohabitation, the Sullivans were also convinced that alcohol was an effective means of relieving anxiety and promoting creativity, a message, of course, that patient Jackson Pollock was happy to hear. But despite all of the sex and booze and promotion of vulnerability, the Sullivans were absolutely not allowed to form steady romantic relationships. To a Sullivanian, sexual jealousy was a, quote, byproduct of a capitalist mentality that saw marriage and monogamy as a form of ownership. Jackson Pollock was, of course, also a fan of this part of the program, mostly because he could cheat on his wife. Things got even more intense when patients considered having children. Women had to seek permission to get pregnant, and while trying to conceive, they would have sex with multiple men in order to take extreme measures to not know the child's biological father. Newton, for his part, did not lead by example. Pierce, his fourth wife. But he did have other wives beyond Pierce soon after. And yes, he had a type. Wives number 5 and 6, Joan Harvey and Helen Moses, were, surprise, surprise, also therapists and higher-ups in the Sullivan Institute. Soon, before his next wives, but after their first apartment building, Newton and Pierce bought another piece of real estate. The Institute's leaders asked these even more serious about their Sullivanian therapeutic work to buy shares in this new building, kind of like a giant psychotherapist co-op. And they did. Therapists and patients would cohabitate, and of course were frequently sleeping with each other. Disturbingly, there was also a training program where specifically chosen patients were invited to train to be therapists themselves. It's unclear to me what this program was actually like, but in my research, it feels like it was yet another way to create a hierarchy in an already muddled, trauma-laden system. With specific tiers of importance in place, Newton would offer free psychotherapy to people who came from broken homes, difficult situations, and low income. Anyone the leader found desirable to the Institute. While this sounds like a generous gesture, when they joined, Newton would ask them to perform babysitting or other various jobs in exchange for therapy. These patients would eventually be given positions of increasing responsibility and made them feel, in classic cult fashion, as if they were part of something much bigger, something important. As the years went on, over 600 patients were working with the Sullivan Institute, over half of them living in the Institute's living spaces. Of course, the same activities continued, sex, parties, community, in a way that created its own disturbing New York ecosystem. Like Jackson Pollock, I can imagine how this might appeal to many bourgeois post-war New Yorkers. The Sullivan Institute was all about therapy and freedom and creativity and expansive ideas and doing what you could to make those things possible. A movement that bypassed the classist limited outlooks that characterized that generation's upbringing. There was also an element of protection to those deep in the Sullivan Institute. Therapists at the Institute wrote letters to the draft board on behalf of patients who were, quote, psychologically unfit to serve in the war in Vietnam, which was, as you'd imagine, also a powerful recruitment tool for the group. Novelist Richard Price was a creative writing student at Columbia when he became involved in the group in 1972. He said, quote, it felt to me like this is just add water and it's instant friends. And you know, girls are going in and out. It's instant sex life. Suddenly, Price went on, it's like somebody opened the gates of heaven. But if Newton opened the gates of heaven for rich New Yorkers, his megalomania might have also opened a portal to hell. More after this break.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Hello.
We're doing a little check-in.
Remember us?
You remember us?
Huh?
We felt like it was check-in time.
You were like, why?
We're back.
Here we are.
We just want to stop in, say hello.
Yeah.
We want to say hello to anyone who's listening, supporting us, spreading the good word of Ghost Town. Thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
We appreciate it.
We do.
If you want to listen to these episodes early access, ad-free, 7 days free, head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod. You can do that. That's a thing.
That's a thing. It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
For most of us.
$2 a month,
mm-hmm.
or you can just listen for 7 days free. There's some bonus episodes. We're working on a bonus episode right now.
Ooh.
By right now? No, not right now. Right now, working on the episode you're listening to.
Yeah, but we'll get another one to you. Don't worry. Don't you worry. You've got a lot in there.
Here's some the sirens of downtown Los Angeles
sirens
for you.
Sirens of Los Angeles.
You want to hear just some of those
Ooh.
Perfectly timed.
You think we're not real? You think we're above this? Look at us.
Yes.
Look at us now.
Sure. I mean, we're in a helicopter pad on mm-hmm. top of a roof.
Yeah. Sipping champagne.
But somewhere down there, things are happening.
Things are happening. That's right.
Also, I'm doing some stand-up shows. Mm. If you happen to want to see some stand-up and you're in any of these areas, I'll be at the Last Bookstore, really cool place in Studio City,
Very fun. Downtown. Yeah.
The Last Bookstore in Studio City is really cool. That's a free show. Might be some free alcohol. See some free comedy, free alcohol. That's at 8 p.m. And I'll be in San Diego this weekend, Friday and Saturday at Comedy Heights at 8 o'clock. And then Saturday, Kensington Comedy at 7:30, doing two shows. And then maybe some other shows I'm going to try to squeeze in. And you can find all that on my Instagram, which is TheJasonHorton. And if I'm ever doing any shows anywhere in any city and money is a barrier, message me. I will get you into the show at any time if it's you and like two other people, three other people. If you got 40 people, Rebecca will take care of that. She'll fly out there and take care of that. You hit up Rebecca for that. But if you just need a couple of people to get in, I will take care of that. But you can find that on my Instagram, The Jason Horton, and I'll let you know if I have some more shows and you just want to say hello.
Yeah, it's fun to say hello to the people you listen to.
Yeah.
You can actually have a conversation with Jason.
And one of these times I'm gonna drag Rebecca back out on the road.
I would love to, truly. Every time you talk about stand-up, I'm like, that sounds very fun. Then I get back to my murders.
Yes. Well, you want to go to a different city? You want to go to New York City?
Let's go back, and there are no murders, spoiler alert, but lots of other things. Let's go back there. In the 1980s, the Sullivan Institute had been going since 1957, so that's almost 30 years, with the head of the institute, Saul Newton, establishing ultimate control over his patients' sex lives, social lives, money, and family life. A Sullivanian's day-to-day was hyper-controlled. They'd have sex with who they were told to have sex with, their income mostly went to dues, fines, and, quote, assessments owed to the institute, and they'd raise their children how their therapists directed, which mostly included demonizing parents and a family unit to, quote, dangerous nuclear family ties. In a book co-authored by Newton and Pierce called The Conditions of Human Growth, they described motherhood as a, quote, unmitigated nightmare, kind of death trap from which both parent and child need to be liberated. These intense ideas around parenthood likely came from Newton and Pierce's own experiences. Newton's mother was a domineering tyrant, according to my research, while Pierce herself had suffered severe postpartum depression after birthing her many, 10 children. Babysitters did most of the caregiving for Sullivanian offspring until the children were shipped off to boarding schools where physical and sexual abuse were rampant. In Alexander Steele's fascinating book, Sex, Psychotherapy, and the Wild Life of an American Commune, he explains that in 1974, 24-year-old Dee Dee Agee, the daughter of the writer James Agee, sent her 5-year-old son Teddy to boarding school. When Teddy's father took the miserable boy to come live with him instead, Agee and a few Sullivanians snuck into his house, kidnapped Teddy, and took him back to the boarding school. After the birth of her second son, Agee was placed under surveillance by her housemates. When the baby did the usual baby things, like cry or throw up, it was held as evidence that Agee was manipulating the child to need her. Agee eventually regained more control over her own parenting and children, but only by ingratiating herself to Newton and beginning a sexual relationship with the leader, who, in 1983, was around 77 years old. It was a classic cult situation, where out-there ideals with kernels of utopia became a total nightmare. In Steele's view, again author of the really excellent book on the subject, quote, "The Sullivanian Institute encapsulates one of the great themes of the 20th century, the tendency of utopian projects of social liberation to take a totalitarian turn." Like all cult leaders, Newton ignored his own principles when it suited him, while taking others to sadistic extremes, such as, of course, sex and sexual abuse. One example from the book details Newton demanding oral sex from seemingly every young woman he encountered, in or out of session, hounding one young patient, named Ellen, on a near daily basis for almost 20 years. Of course, abuse breeds abuse, and Ellen matured into one of the Institute's most tyrannical therapists. At one point, the book darkly notes, urging a teenager who had overslept her alarm to die by suicide. As the times change, paranoia became rampant within the Sullivan Institute, determined to preserve itself at any cost. When the nuclear accident happened at Three Mile Island in 1979, the whole group flew to Florida because the leadership told them that New York City was now unsafe. During the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, new restrictions were put in place. Members were disallowed from sleeping with people outside of the group, as well as from eating any food not prepared by a group member. The group was also turning violent. In 1985, when the recent college graduates who lived next door to one of the group buildings refused to move some paint they had spilled on the building, the group broke in and attacked their own apartment, smashing dishes, furniture, sinks, and toilets. And, quote, "When one of the young men came over to protest what had happened, one of the men from the group pulled them into the lobby and hit the boy so hard he broke his own wrist." By the mid-1980s, the Sullivanians were splintering under the weight of what they had sown. Violence, custody battles, defections, money troubles, negative media attention, and investigations into professional misconduct and child abuse. At least 4 of the group's therapists lost their licenses, while children of the Sullivanians, now adults, began connecting with each other to piece together their biological identities and truths around their upbringings. Steele writes that in destroying the family, the Sullivanians also replicated its ugliest dynamics. Newton was the tyrannical father, his therapist wives were enabling mothers, and the lower-ranking patients were the terrified children, scrambling for Newton's unattainable approval. Newton died in 1991 from sepsis following the onset of Alzheimer's disease. By that point, he had been married and divorced 6 times. Without his leadership, a year later, the Sullivan Institute permanently shut its doors. Saul Newton's New York Times obituary is also telling of his reputation at the time, noting that he was, quote, "a psychotherapist who ran an unorthodox commune in Manhattan that was assailed by ex-members as an abusive cult." Many of the famous people who passed through the Sullivan Institute reflected on their involvement after the fact, and let's just say, looking back, they were not proud of their work there. Famed folk musician Judy Collins, for example, was under Sullivanian therapeutic care for 15 years. In her memoir, she wrote, quote, "I sure got a lot of mileage out of the Sullivanian belief that alcohol was good for anxiety, and that having multiple sex partners was a political statement and a healthy lifestyle. Only later, after I had left them, did I realize I had fallen under the spell of a cult." In 2019, custody battles continued to ensue for parents and children of the Sullivan Institute, with confusing and often heartbreaking results. In one case, a father who had left the group spent years fighting for custody of his twin girls, only to find out many years later that he was not their biological father at all. Through a traumatic result of sexual coercion, sexual abuse, and mental abuse, as of today, many of the children of Sullivanians are committed to rebuilding their relationships with their siblings and sometimes parents, eager to recultivate bonds lost in the strict Sullivanian credo. Despite having to confront the traumas inflicted by the Sullivan Institute, these gestures bring reflection and maybe even some optimism. Said one child of Sullivanian parents, Kath Cherney, quote, "Somebody can be complicated, but you can still love them."